This is Thought Crime. I am your host, Wesley Fox, and for this episode 44, I'm going to talk Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. And for just like all other movie podcasts or podcasts where we talk about movies, this is for people that have already seen the movie. I will be talking about the whole thing. There will be spoilers. So if you have not seen the movie, first off, I'm going to tell you it's a very good movie. I do recommend you go see it for Star Wars fans and for general moviegoers that like action, sci-fi action movies. It is a good movie. There's not really too many surprises in terms of the style and what you're going to see. The trailers basically give you a good idea of what kind of movie you're getting into. So for those of you who have not seen it, that's my message to you. I do recommend it. Go see it. For those of you that have not seen it, this is your chance to stop the podcast, go out and watch it, and then come back and listen to this show. So, 3 seconds. 1, 2, 3. Blah. All right. I saw the movie on Saturday, the day after the premiere, so I'm a little bit late. I didn't see it the first day because I just did not dish out the money. It got sold out in this area, and I wanted to see it with a few friends, so we decided to watch the new 12:45 showing on Saturday, midday. And walking out of it, my first impressions of the movie is, one, it's a good movie. It's entertaining. It's fun. It's partially fun, but it's actually more of a serious movie. I would say that compared to the other Star Wars movies, and again, this is not, as all of you probably already know, this is not part of the saga in terms of episodes. This is a prequel to episode 4, in between 3 and 4, but it takes place almost barely a month or a few weeks before the beginning of A New Hope, episode 4. So it is a prequel in that sense. It is a gap filler, and it is not meant to be part of the saga. So the layout, the style, the kind of feel that this movie has is different from the seven movies. It is distinct from all of them. It is distinct from Force Awakens. It is distinctive from the cartoons and everything else that we have in the Star Wars canon to date. It is a kind of a different kind of movie. And so there's a few things, right? It's not quite as kid-friendly as the other movies are. Kids can watch this movie. There's really nothing wrong with that. Maybe if your kids are under the age of 10, maybe I'd be a little worried. But other than that, I wouldn't worry at all. But this obviously is not designed for... it's darker, it's grittier, it's kind of... a lot of the romantic and kind of fairy tale elements of the seven movies is not present in this one at all, in the aesthetic and also in the storyline itself. So kids probably will not enjoy this movie, younger kids in particular, will not enjoy this movie as much as they would enjoy the other seven movies, say. I also think hardcore Star Wars fans, I think there's going to be a mixture of responses, and I'll try to get into that a little bit later. But basically, this is the style of this movie is something that it's not adult, it's not rated R, but it's obviously not geared towards the full family experience. This is geared towards tweens, teens, and adults. It's not as well designed for kids. If I had to describe this movie like in a very simple way, I guess, to start off with, is the two things that I took away from this are, one is this movie is a lot about sacrifice. It's a lot about giving up a lot for a cause, for yourself, and etc. This is a lot about sacrifice. This is not about destiny. This is not about following the path. This is not about training. This is not about overcoming evil. This is about what regular people have to do to make the galaxy better. And so they have to give up quite a bit, and a lot of them have suffered. They are not really the kind of people they want to be, and this is not the galaxy they want to live in. They're not happy. Nobody in this movie is really happy, and they've decided to give something to make the galaxy better. And that's the first thing. The second thing is that this movie is about share. I mean, there is Jyn Erso is the protagonist and the main hero in this movie, but this movie has a lot of heroes in it, and it's kind of one of the other messages I think of this movie is that the rebellion at that stage, and maybe the whole rebellion, was a group effort. This was not just about one general or one hero, one Luke Skywalker or Han Solo, you know, single-handedly defeating the Empire. This movie kind of shows you a lot of the things and a lot of the sacrifices and great kind of heroic acts of a lot of different characters that got us to Episode 4, A New Hope. And I think that was maybe one of the other things they wanted to convey, that this bigger, broader saga has a lot of other moving parts and characters, and all of them had a lot to do with this. It wasn't just about Luke and Darth Vader and Han and Leia, that this conflict and this saga is a much bigger conflict, and for the sake of kind of telling a broader story about the more of the characters and more of the people involved, they kind of showed you more. And you definitely, by the end of the movie, you get the sense that this was a group effort. The rebellion as a whole defeated the Empire, not Luke Skywalker by himself. And I think that, and I like both of those messages, the sacrifice and kind of the shared collective sacrifice and efforts of the rebellion finally, you know, being communicated in this movie. I think both of those things come across very, very well. Another thing is that this is a not so romantic view of the rebellion and of the war in general. The good versus evil, you know, the hero in a one-on-one duel with the villain, and kind of the, you know, Han Solo or Lando kind of being in the middle of the key battles and being there in the end and getting all the glory, the medals and everything. That's all kind of a romantic view of war. And I think Star Wars generally does have an overly romanticized view of war. It's only recently that, for one, our movies, you know, American film has started to move away from that to some extent in other movies like Saving Private Ryan or We Were Soldiers. Like, those kind of war movies have kind of moved a little bit away from that. And I think Star Wars Force Awakens did not, and because this is a sci-fi epic and you know, it's a that kind of a show. But this movie is not. This movie is far more realistic. It's a lot grittier, and it's kind of showing the kind of shades of gray in this war, and also the kind of, you know, sometimes the good guy dies, you know, a not so dignified and epic and deserving death. And imagine in Braveheart that in the first battle, when they're all standing there in, I think it was Stirling, and they're taunting the English, and they're kind of doing all that, and then those waves of arrows come in. Now imagine in that scene that one of those arrows strikes William Wallace in the head and kills him instantly. In the movie, you see Scottish warriors die from the arrow, from the arch, from the barrage, wounded, killed, whatever, you know. So imagine that the big hero, the leader of the Scottish rebellion, William Wallace, you know, an arrow just happens to come through over his shield, hits him in the head, and kills him. Now, that's obviously makes for a bad movie, right? And a bad story, and it's not very heroic. And it's kind of like, you know, he's the big honcho, but he shouldn't die that way. He should die, you know, doing battle with the other side's general, the other side's leader. He should be killing of the prince. You know, there should be some final duel, like in the Iliad, when Hector and Achilles go at it one-on-one. You know, those are the kind of things, like when you're watching a romantic war movie, that's what you see. You see the best soldiers and the best warriors, the best leaders, they live the longest, and they're the ones that are in there in the end, and their contribution is kind of like the pivotal contribution that turns the war. And they will sometimes have like a duel right in the middle of the battlefield, and everyone will watch, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Rogue One throws all of that out and does not try to do that. Rogue One shows numerous heroes dying in numerous ways, or, you know, some of them do survive, but most of them perish in their efforts to steal the plans to, first of all, get the message to the rebellion of the existence of the Death Star, and secondly, to steal the plans. And you see the contributions that there wasn't just one big hero like Jyn Erso or Cassian Andor. So if you're going to watch this movie and you think this is a Jyn Erso movie or a Cassian Andor movie, not really the case. And this is a much more grittier, much more realistic, and much more modern, modernist take on war and how senseless and unfair and kind of unromantic and pointless it can be. This movie isn't pointless is too far. Pointless is kind of what other war critics and modernist writers would do. So I wouldn't say maybe pointless is too far, but this kind of shows that there's a lot of things in warfare that just don't make a lot of sense. And maybe there's certain elements of it from a certain point of view are pointless. So I think that's one of the biggest interesting things. This is the first Star Wars product to do that kind of thing. I think they did it fairly well. I think those things came off very well. I think the senselessness of the slaughter and the death that takes place at the hands of the Empire, that there doesn't really seem to be any kind of redeeming justification for it. It's all for the purposes of power and fear. Also, just a lot of people die, you know, for that. It's just unfair. You know, they're not even warriors. You know, they're innocent and they're killed for reasons that are just completely unfair and just make you angry. That's the kind of movie this is. And I think they effectively, they hit on those notes. And I think thematically they did a very good job of those things. So that would be like, that's the bulk of my first real impressions of this movie and what I think they came across very well that the other Star Wars movies do not do. And I think they did a pretty good job of that. All right. Onto the continuity. I want to talk a little bit about continuity and about how rebellions and these kind of group efforts, you know, it's not one person, it's usually a large group of people. But in the case of this particular movie and the saga, the overall message you get from this is that this is not about one hero, and that a lot of the conflict and a lot of the good versus evil, Jedi, Sith, or, you know, the dark side and the light, there's always a passing of the guard kind of feel to it. That there's always the passing of the baton, that every individual plays a role in this ongoing saga. We start off with Qui-Gon Jinn being the key role player in and the top Jedi Knight going up against the Sith and trying to reverse the fortunes of Naboo. Qui-Gon dies, and he passes it on to Obi-Wan Kenobi and his new Padawan, Anakin Skywalker. And they're the ones that that are at the key center of fighting evil. Qui-Gon Jinn's gone. And so it's up to Obi-Wan and Anakin to lead the fight. And in a way, Obi-Wan in the third movie hands it off to Anakin because it's Anakin that defeats Count Dooku. So there's kind of a passing of the torch there to some extent, although it's not really kind of linear in that case because Obi-Wan is alive and he does defeat General Grievous after Dooku, but you do see that. And then when Anakin turns to the dark side, Obi-Wan's passing of the torch and his role in the battle, in the epic good versus evil kind of balance, ends with his passing of the torch to Luke Skywalker in Episode 4. And it's up to Luke. He's their new hope, you know, their only hope. And you get the impression in the movie The Force Awakens that you might see a passing of the torch from Luke Skywalker to Ren. That's not, you know, that's the impression you get at the end of that movie. In Rogue One, you get the passing of the torch. There's a different kind of line here. This is a different part of the conflict, but you get the sense that Cassian Andor and Jyn Erso, and actually it kind of starts with Galen Erso, Jyn Erso's father. Galen Erso, just for really quick background, all of you should already know this, but just to say it out loud, he is one of the key scientists working on the Death Star weapon program, and it is his work that makes the weapon possible, I guess. And he does not believe in it. He obviously is horrified by it, so he intentionally, as we saw in the movie, builds an intentional flaw in the design of the Death Star, passes it to a pilot who passes it to Saul Guerrera, Forrest Whitaker's character, who passes it to Jyn Erso, and Jyn Erso takes it upon herself to get the plans of the Death Star and find the flaw and get that to the rebellion. Jyn Erso does that, succeeds, and hands those plans off to Princess Leia. At the beginning of A New Hope, Princess Leia hands those off to R2-D2. R2-D2 hands those plans off to Obi-Wan Kenobi, who hands them off to Luke. Luke brings them to the rebellion, and it is Luke that ultimately leads the assault and destroys the Death Star. So it's like the passing of the baton. Like this war and this kind of conflict, it's not about one duel between two top players. This is the passing of the baton between various heroes from period to movie, and that's really a lot of characters and a lot of, you know, heroes play a part in this, and a lot of villains. We got introduced to director Krennic. We saw a little bit more of Tarkin. We already know about Darth Vader and the evil emperor and characters like that. So we see a little bit more of the villains and their contributions or their failures. Just as we did in the prequels, we saw a lot more about the roles of Darth Maul, Count Dooku, General Grievous. In the cartoons, you see Asajj Ventress and Savage Opress. So you see a little bit more of what the role of the villains play in these. There's not quite the clear... I haven't thought about too much about the passing of the baton on the villain side. You really don't get too much of that, although you do sense that, obviously, Count Dooku is the replacement for Darth Maul. Darth Vader is the replacement for Count Dooku. And when actually Luke Skywalker was meant to be Darth Vader's replacement. I mean, that was the idea. And then as another twist in Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader was going to replace Darth Sidious and have Luke be his right-hand man and rule as father and son. So the villains also do a little bit of this passing of the baton to some extent, although their efforts are usually, you know, largely failures. Darth Maul fails to defeat Obi-Wan Kenobi. Count Dooku succeeds in starting the war, but then fails to defeat Anakin and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Darth Vader succeeds in killing Obi-Wan Kenobi, but he fails to protect the Death Star. He fails to destroy Luke Skywalker or turn Luke Skywalker. So there's not quite the same kind of baton tossing on the villain side. And I think maybe, you know, in order for the movie to be palatable for Americans, you know, the happy ending, good triumphs evil, I think you get a little bit more of the baton passing on the good side, whereas on the villains are a lot more selfish and more self-interested and do things on a transactional path rather than, you know, carrying on this ongoing cause. That is just not really what happens in the movies for the Sith. We might see that change in the new movies. We might not. They might continue to treat evil in a distinct way compared to the rebellion. So we'll see. All right. Another thing about this movie is that it kind of relies a little bit on your familiarity with the Star Wars universe. There's some fan service in this movie, and there are some details and things that they don't really explain very well. But if you've seen Star Wars Clone Wars, or you've seen the 6-7 movies, or you've read some of the novels, you're very familiar with what's going on in this movie. If you've only seen a few of the movies, maybe you've seen all the movies, but you have not seen the cartoons, you've never read the books, you don't really know that much, a couple things in this movie might not have been very clear to you. And I think one of the things that they present in this movie, and they don't go into a lot of detail, and maybe, you know, you don't really know, but is the importance of kyber crystals. The crystals that the Empire is trying to mine out of Jada and some of these other planets, these are the crystals that power lightsabers. They are very important for a number of reasons. They're a power source, and Galen Erso is responsible for using them and turning them into a super weapon. If you line them all up together, you can create he creates the Death Star. That's just one kind of thing. There's a few other things. There's a few other characters that kind of show up that if you don't really know the saga very well, you probably didn't catch it or you just didn't care. For example, Jimmy Smits is Bail Organa. Bail Organa basically is one of the key individuals responsible for the rebellion. He was a senator during the Revenge of the Sith movie, and he's the one that secretly helps build a rebellion when the Jedi are thought to be extinct, and there's nobody there to stand in the way of the Emperor. They slowly build a rebellion over 15, 20 years, and Bail Organa is at the center of it, and he's, of course, the adopted father of Princess Leia. So he makes a couple scenes, he's in the movie in a few places, but if you weren't familiar with that, you might have missed that, but I'm sure most viewers probably caught that. The importance of Senator Mon Mothma, who is the red-haired woman in the white robe that you see in Episode 3, but you also her character is also in Return of the Jedi. She's also a key player because she was actually an important ally of Padme Amidala during the Clone Wars, and she's also one of the key components of that helped build the Alliance and the Rebellion when the Empire was just in total control. So those two characters make kind of scenes, and they're important. We also run into the two characters from the Mos Eisley Cantina, you know, the guys that knock into Luke Skywalker and tell him, like, I don't like you. He doesn't like you either. You better watch yourself. So that was a cool little thing. I thought that was fun. There's a couple others. Those are the two that step out the most, but there's a few other mentions of characters or moments from the other movies or from the cartoons. Saul Guerrera, I guess, played by Forrest Whitaker. I guess he was in Clone Wars. I don't remember him. And he is going to be in Star Wars Rebels when Season 3 picks up next year. So there are some tie-ins. There's some additional tie-ins that I might have missed. I didn't catch them all. But if you are not a hardcore Star Wars fan, you probably didn't catch any of them. And those parts of the movie didn't really make any kind of impact on you because you don't know who they are. And they don't know why. You don't know why they're important. Everyone knows the Death Star. Everyone knows Darth Vader. So to see the origins of that, that is kind of the key focus of most of the movie. So they kind of stick to things that their intended audience ought to know. They ought to know about the Death Star. They ought to know about the Death Star plans being stolen and being used to ultimately destroy it in Episode 4. And they should know maybe a few other side things about... I mean, they should know about Darth Vader and etc. So... most of the movie doesn't... you don't really need to be a Star Wars fan to enjoy this movie, but there are some pieces to it that only a hardcore fan would catch on and appreciate. All right, I'll say one more positive thing about the movie, and then I'll get into the critique. I wanted to be positive first because, on the whole, I like this movie. I thought it was an enjoyable movie. It was worth seeing. It was worth the money. I think I do recommend it for others. There are some things I did not like about it, but I wanted to kind of be positive first and then get to the negatives later. So I will do... this is the one other thing I thought was very cool. I thought this movie had a great ending. It was a powerful dedication to those who fell and those who sacrificed to bring the Death Star down and ultimately leads to the fall of the Empire. It is a kind of this idea that there are so many that we did not get to see in the other movies that were nameless, their stories were not told. We only really knew about Luke and Han and Leia and Lando Calrissian. We didn't get to know about the many, many others that weren't force sensitive. They didn't have Jedi friends. They weren't princesses. They weren't royalty. You know, they were just regular people fighting in this rebellion. And this movie is kind of a dedication to what they did that made Episode 4 possible. Everything we saw in Episode 4 is made possible thanks to Jyn Erso and Cassian Andor and these other characters. And they're not Jedi, and they're not powerful. They don't have a lot of friends. They're not politically connected, but they found a way to make it happen. So these kind of like working class, you know, just kind of grunts, criminals, you know, these bunch of no names, and they have nothing going for them except for their commitment to the cause. This movie is kind of a dedication to them, and the ending is fantastic. It's a great kind of dedication to them. Even though, I mean, these are all fictional characters. This war isn't real. I know that. But for the saga and for a lot of, the expanded universe, it kind of shows a side to the rebellion and it shows a side to the Star Wars universe that this is not about royalty and this is not about, you know, the talented Skywalker family. And I think that's also partially what they wanted to accomplish with this movie by stepping out of the saga episodic timeline of 1 through 7. I think they succeeded there, and I liked it a lot. I liked the ending, and I liked how you saw how many people died to get those plans out of away, and how close Darth Vader got to securing them, and just how ferocious Darth Vader was in his pursuit of them and Tarkin. Admiral Tarkin. So that was... I thought I liked that a lot. I thought it was done very well, and I do appreciate... I definitely appreciated like some of the things they were trying to do, and recognizing that not all heroes are princesses or you know, heirs or destiny bound, you know, Skywalkers, etc. I thought that was a very cool little, like, almost an American kind of appreciation that rebellions are usually led by the rejects of society, just like we were. All right, time for the criticism, the things that took away from this movie for me. And I think also, when compared to the seven movies, I would say that all three of the original threes are better than Rogue One. I also feel like Force Awakens was a better movie than Rogue One. As for the prequels, this movie is better than Phantom Menace, which obviously is not saying much. I do believe it's maybe a little bit better than Attack of the Clones. And I did like Revenge of the Sith. I don't think it was a great movie, but I thought of the prequels, Revenge of the Sith was the strongest and had the most compelling moments. It had some cringy, you know, cringeworthy moments. And so the movie's not a great movie, but it's a good movie. I would put Rogue One right around Revenge of the Sith. A good movie, a good Star Wars movie, but not a great movie. And probably not that's going to stick with people eternally the way that 4, 5, and 6 do. And I do believe in the end, episode 7, a lot of the things from episode 7 will stick with people for time to come. But the big thing, I guess the biggest knock I have on Rogue One is that it's really rapid. It moves really fast. It runs through the beginning, jumping from planet to planet, introducing you to character after character after character. And then the music is all dramatic and everything's high-paced. The scenes are only like 1 or 2 minutes long. And you're barely getting a handle on who these people are before they're all thrown together in the middle of the movie. And the kind of broader story arc is revealed. The main protagonist, Jyn Erso, you see in the beginning of the movie, she witnesses her mother's murder and basically her father being seized. After that, Jyn Erso, and played by Felicity Jones, hardly ever talks. So a lot of her character is built around what you saw in the first 15 minutes of the movie or 10 minutes of the movie. She doesn't talk. And when she does talk, it's, you know, she's kind of, and a lot of the characters do, they talk to each other like they've already kind of know each other, and that there's all these conversations that took place that just we missed. And that's why I kind of feel like maybe the extended version of this movie might fill in a lot of this, because I really felt like I didn't understand Jyn Erso at all until it took a while before it started put together. And just honestly, she just was not really a fully developed hero because she hardly talks and you learn nothing of her life after her father is taken. They give you some very, very scant and generalized details, and they leave it to your imagination to fill it in. The same goes for Cassian Andor. You never really know what the hell his story is, but he gives you a little bit, you know, some vague details, and he lets you fill it in. I think they were relying on the fans and on the people that were going to be familiar with the Star Wars universe to fill in those gaps themselves and put it all together for them, because this movie didn't. Jyn Erso just really is not a very fully formed character. I mean, she's admirable in many ways, and she's ultimately the protagonist of this movie, but she's not, I mean, in comparison to the other, you know, heroines of this saga and other heroines of sci-fi and fantasy, she just does not leave a lasting impression with me. She has some great lines towards the second half of the movie, but it's like, we don't know, why is this random woman saying all these very provocative and thought, you know, these profound things, and everyone's rallying around her. It's like, well, the whole movie tried to convince us she's a nobody, she's a criminal. The only reason they want her is that she happens to be related to one of the key scientists. That's it. So that did not work very well for me. The two key characters at the end of the movie, as great as the ending is, you know, you don't really get a really good grip on who the hell Jyn Erso and Cassian Andor are. The two other side characters that join their little crew, Shirut Imwe and Baze Malbus. Apparently they're from Jada, the planet Jada, which had a major large Jedi temple with a lot of kyber crystals in it. Again, you're kind of left to fill that in yourself. That's not really very clear. I mean, they do say it in the movie, but it's not very clear. And I would not be surprised if a lot of casual moviegoers miss that part. But they're not Jedi. Neither of these characters, Sherrod and Baze, they're not Jedi, but they are clearly Jedi sympathizers. They're kind of the religion of Jediism, so they are very much part of the... they are anti-imperial and they are anti, you know, all that, but they're not part of the rebellion for some reason. You know, their chemistry between them, they have some very cool moments here and there, but it's very brief. I mean, they kind of put it together very quickly and they develop them very quickly, and there's just not really, there's some depth and there's some understanding, but again, you're kind of left to fill in a lot of it yourself based on what they say to each other and how they are towards each other. You're kind of doing the work as a moviegoer to put these things together yourself. So I did not think that was, I thought that was rushed. I thought the whole thing was thrown together. We were made to like think of these characters as a kind of motley crew of some kind, and that they're all kind of these unique heroes. But I really just felt like I never really got to know any of them. They were all strangers, and when they all, you know, when they all go to Scarif to steal the plans, they're all strangers to me. And so I didn't get that same emotional rush that this was like the coming together of some new vanguard. That's just not how it felt. Forrest Whitaker, Saw Gerrera, all his role is basically to play Galen Erso's message to her daughter, and that's it. The buildup of his character, of his mechanical side, of his breathing, of how he's this radical that broke off from the Alliance because he's too crazy. They never explain what exactly is too crazy about him or why he broke away from the Rebellion or the Alliance. So that whole thing is just, you know, why is he not a friend and why do we need to find Jyn Erso? This is all kind of a convenient little thing, so that way they need Jyn Erso and they break her out of prison. None of it's explained, and none of it seems to serve any purpose other than to create a need to find Jyn Erso. It just ended up being irrelevant. His character ended up just basically being, hey, here you go, here's a message. I mean, Forrest Whitaker is just horribly underutilized, in my opinion. The droid in this movie, K2SO, voiced by Alan Tudyk, was very funny, very cool, comic relief. He plays the role that the droids normally play in these movies, R2-D2, C-3PO, Chopper in Star Wars Rebels. So he did that, and he performed very well. And he was a very, very likable character, droid character, and he's very unusual. And that was a great job. I think that was a good... I mean, they do a good job of... Or I'm sorry, BB-8, too. That's the other one. From Force Awakens. They do a great job of creating new droid characters that are just great little comic relief additions and clever and very just lovable, just adorable. So they did a good job with that one here. He's the only real lovable character in this movie. The rest of them are just too gritty and, you know, it's hard to really love them. You respect them and admire them in the end, but, you know, you don't really get to like any of them. And I want to give a shout out to Admiral Raddus, who I didn't know anything about his character until this movie, and I feel like I don't think anyone knows anything about him unless you're a hardcore Star Wars Expanded Universe fan. I'm not. And I just feel like in this movie, Admiral Raddus was the man that made this possible. The stealing of the plans, he's the one that brought his fleet in to engage and to try to open up an opportunity for the people on the ground to steal the plans, broadcast the plans, and get them the hell out of Scarif before Darth Vader comes in. So he takes massive risks. He's the one that believes in this. He's the one that just charges in on his own to make this happen. He believes in all this. He does not believe in running and hiding from the Death Star. He's willing to sacrifice himself and his people and to do what is necessary. So he was a very... He doesn't get really a lot of lines in this other than, you know, observing the battle. And you never really get to know him, but you see in the movie he plays a very important role and a very admirable role, and he definitely is a key component to the success of this movie and the battle and the final part of the movie. So he's I don't know. I thought he was very cool. In the end, I was like, dude, the Admiral Raddus is one of the guys that just made this happen. I mean, obviously, Jyn Erso and Cassian Andor did a lot of the heavy lifting, and a lot of the commandos that landed on Scarif with them. And I mean, obviously, all of them played a role. But I mean, up in the orbit, Admiral Raddus, you know, he just showed up once he found out what was happening. He shows up, he breaks the shield, he makes it happen, and he didn't even know about the mission. But once he found out it was underway, he's like, "I'm going to help. Like, I'm not waiting. I don't know if they have any chance of success. I don't know what's going on, but I'm going there. Like, I don't know what you guys are doing, but I'm going to see if I can make this happen." I thought that was very cool. I think the casting was a good job. Nothing really wrong with the cast. Felicity Jones is a very, very talented actress. I think she was a little bit underused here. Diego Luna did a tremendous job. Ben Mendelsohn as Krennic did a pretty good job. Forest Whitaker, underused. Alan Tudyk, good voiceover. James Earl Jones does the voice for Darth Vader, so that was very cool. And so yeah, no real complaints about that, and no real complaints about what was said in the movie. I guess my complaint is all the things that were not said in this movie, and a lot of the explosions and flashing lights and everything that kind of took the place of character development and I don't know, a little bit more context. The music, I mean, John Williams is obviously the core of the Star Wars movies, and a big part of the Star Wars success, in my opinion, is the score. This movie has a pretty strong score, but I think, like, some of the scenes, like, you see a ship coming out of hyperspace and landing on some planet, and the music is just going nuts. Like, this is some sort of dramatic, like, scene where big things are happening, and all we're seeing is a ship land. Like, we see ships land about 12 times in this movie. So, like, every time I see a ship land and this music's going crazy, like, this is the biggest thing to happen in the movie. Like, it's overly dramatic, it's over the top, and, like, after a while, I was like, okay, all right, guys, you could have just taken this down a notch a little. Because, you know, you keep playing this dramatic, like, music, you know, like, something, you know, this big thing, this is the climax of the opera or something, and all that happens is a ship fucking lands on a platform on some planet. I mean, anyway, overall, the music's good, but they kind of try to play up a lot of this stuff, like everything that happens in this movie is incredibly dramatic and important to the narrative, and that's just not true. Rogue One has plenty of scenes that are connectors and kind of context and character development, or are very just minor plot points. Not everything that happens in this movie is extremely, you know, just... you know, will punch at your heart. You know, it's not, I'm sorry, movies don't do that. Generally, movies don't do that, and Rogue One doesn't do that. But the music makes you think that everything that happens in this movie is just incredible. And just, yeah, I would have toned, I just, in my opinion, I would have toned the music down a little bit in a few scenes and maybe just said, okay, this is just a ship landing. We don't need to get the full orchestra involved. You know, like, this is the epic battle of good and evil. Like, this is a ship landing. One final note. I thought it was very cool the way they included legacy characters. They did not... most of it's not really fan service. It's actually important to the plot. Admiral Tarkin's role, who's a CGI character, because I think the actor who played him passed away a while ago. So they CGI'd Tarkin in, and Tarkin is a foil to Krennic, because Krennic wants to be the guy who runs the Death Star and wants all the glory, and he's a ladder climber kind of character, and Tarkin kind of undermines him. And so a lot of what happens here is because Krennic is overly ambitious and zealous. I don't know if that really landed as strongly as the movie wanted. I don't really think Krennic was really that great of a villain. I think the great villain of this movie is the great villain of the whole saga, Darth Vader. And Darth Vader doesn't just do a cameo in a scene or two. He is important to... there's one scene where he's kind of like, yeah, it's a little bit of a cameo. But I think the way he's rendered, I do believe they used James Earl Jones to do his voice. And he is just every bit as terrifying in this movie as he is in the original three. The way he just slashes his way through the rebel ship in search of the plans. He's invincible. You feel like he's invincible. You have all these guys shooting at him, and he's just too powerful. He's just too fast with his lightsaber. He can choke you and throw you around the corridor. It was very cool. And the parts showing his deformed and burnt body, and you just get the sense that all the Imperial troopers and everyone, they treat him as obviously a VIP and not one to be fucked with. And he is obviously the one that, he's not worried about climbing ladders. He's just worried about getting things done, and he'll kill even his own people to make it happen. So I thought that was a very cool inclusion, a little bit more than a cameo. The Princess Leia scene at the end of the movie is basically a connector to A New Hope. So yeah, you could call that kind of a CGI cameo. It's not Carrie Fisher. It is a CGI of Carrie Fisher. I don't know if she really helped in rendering that or not, but it's very clear that it's CGI and not actually Carrie Fisher trying to pretend that she's 40 years younger. And as you probably would have heard from our review of A Force Awakens, me and Microsoft Matt, Carrie Fisher just can't bring it anymore. She did not do a good job in A Force Awakens, and we're all kind of hoping that her role in the episodes 8 and 9 are not as big, because she just simply doesn't seem to have the ability to emote much. Her face is stone, her eyes are stone, her delivery of lines her lines weren't that good. So that's just, my thought on Carrie Fisher and the character. I don't think it's the character, and I don't think it's because she's a woman. I know some people might throw that at me, but let's be honest. You watch that movie, Harrison Ford obviously delivers. A lot of these older actors, when they have to come back and be part of the reboots or part of the sequels, they all, more often than not, can deliver what they're asked for. Carrie Fisher did not. Watch the movie again and tell me I'm wrong. She just, her facial expressions never change. You don't get the impression that she actually is a general. She's just kind of a spectator. So anyway, my overall assessment of the movie is that I think that if there is an extended version, and there almost always is, I have a feeling that there's going to be about 10 to 20 minutes of additional scenes that were cut away because they were just dialogue and character development and kind of contextual. The scenes that I feel like were necessary for this movie were probably the ones that fell to the editing floor and are part of the extended version. So if you watch that, that movie's probably 2.5 to 3 hours long, but you probably get a much, much better sense of who the hell Jen Erso is, who the hell Cassian Andor is. Maybe you learn a little bit more about Sered Imwe and Faze Balbus, or whatever their characters. Let me see if I. Baze Malbus, I'm sorry. Sered Imwe and Baze Malbus. I mean, you don't. The other thing about this movie is you never. They introduce themselves or say their names, but you can barely hear it, and you don't even remember their names. Like, you know who they are and what they are, but like, you can never really tell what. That's like, you get the basic biographical stuff, and that's it. But. And also, you get the impression that some of these people do believe in the Force, but they're not Force wielders. They're not Force sensitive. But that doesn't mean you can't be religiously dedicated to the Jedi faith and the spiritualism of the Force, which is a lot of it based on Taoism, Buddhism, and Eastern philosophies. So I think that's what this movie is showing. This is showing regular people, regular non-Force sensitive people that believe in this faith and believe in these things, and maybe have developed some special skills, like the blind warrior. I think that there could be a case made for that. He's not a Jedi, but you get the impression that his study of the Force has allowed him to advance some of his normal skills. That maybe maybe he's not Force sensitive, but maybe it enhances some of his non-Force skills. So, anywho. All right, so I think I will probably wrap it up there. I don't think I have anything else to say. I guess to sum up, Rogue One, good movie. I recommend seeing it for Star Wars fans. I think hardcore fans might have mixed feelings because it just doesn't, it might not deliver enough of what they want, or maybe it tries too hard to capture, I don't know. I've heard a couple of criticisms from hardcore fans that hated it for different reasons, and I think no matter what you do for something like this, there's always going to be a section of hardcore fans that will be upset no matter what you do, and I think that's the case here. As for people that like Star Wars but are not hardcore fans, you'll enjoy this movie. It's a good movie. I mean, it's not as good as Force Awakens, but it's a good movie, and I think it's a good story. For general casual movie fans, I recommend this movie a lot. It's a lot of fun to watch. I mean, it's great stuff. There's a lot of great stuff in this movie. The visuals are amazing. The CGI, some of the combat sequences are very cool. For myself, I would probably, if I had to give it a rating, I guess 4 stars, but, I don't know if that really matters too much. But it's a good movie. I recommend it. It's gritty. Shows a different side of the Star Wars saga and the rebellion. And I think that will do it. I think the next episode of Thought Crime, I will be reviewing Passengers. I will try to watch it on Wednesday and do the review and post it Wednesday night or Thursday. And because I am going on vacation for the holidays, I will be gone for a week. But I will try to get the Passengers review out before I go on vacation on Thursday or Friday. So that is the goal. I'm going to try and make that happen. I am excited about that movie. I am, some reviews are starting to come out that are not too positive on this, but I will wait. I will withhold judgment and I will watch it myself. I love Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. So that is the next episode. But I will have to, for this one, I will sign off, and until next time.